A little top up for you, Cathers.
Absolutely.
Bit of pros.
It would be rude not to on our special Sunday recording session.
We've had such a wholesome day. We went to the gym.
We did. We started this morning with an exercise class. Hello, honeys, by the way.
Oh, hello.
Hey, guys. Welcome back once again to Straight Up the Pop Culture Podcast, hosted by journalist Catalina Nelly. That's us.
You sounded like a wheezing balloon.
We have had quite the Sunday. We started with a little co-box class using our yonder points.
Fucking love yonder. So we maybe died. I also, did you see, I started off the class without gloves.
Yeah, I did wonder what was going on there. I was like, why is Ellie leaving the class when it's just started?
I was like, oh, I don't.
Wandering around looking a bit lost.
It's so classic me to be in a boxing class and the only one that hasn't got gloves.
Yeah. That was.
And then the instructor gave me two left gloves. So was, and I put them on. I put them on, started punching the bag. And I was like, something is not right here.
It was quite funny watching from behind because I was behind Ellie. And this is just to say, neither of us are the most sporty people. Maybe perhaps not the most like coordinated. And so watching you punch the punch bag, I was like, that's what I look like.
Yeah.
And oh my God, we do stick out in this class like sore thumbs as the newbies.
I felt really bad because I was like, I am watching the gun in front of me like a hawk. So poor Kathleen has to watch me to know what's going
like,
on.
Like 2-2-1. Three, whatever the punching.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Regime is. Well, anyway. All the same. Glad we tried it.
Glad. I mean, I was a little bit hungover because I went to a singles night last night.
A singles night? How very fitting for our Dolly Alderton episode.
Yes, it is. I went.
Tell
as
me
a,
more.
A sneaky little fraud.
Yeah. Why were you there?
because
we
I
need
was
background.
Yes.
Honey.
Sorry. I was dropping off some single gals and guys.
Cute.
And I thought, you know, I'm going to be there. Do a few intros, have a few drinks, but then before I knew it, it was 12:30.
You were part of the singles
and other
night.
People had left before me.
Yeah.
And I said to Issa, I was like, we can't be the last.
Oh my God, was
people.
He there as well? Okay, that's literally hilarious. So you both went to the singles night. Were they like, guys, you could have gone and done your own date this evening, but
someone actually just hit on me with a lime. They said, here's my chat up lime.
I hate that.
And gave
they
me
just
a lime.
Get in
the bin. Yeah. And I gave it back to them. I said, no.
I'm actually here with my boyfriend of 10 plus years I got together with at 18. So
actually, not to sound really okay, there is no way of me saying this without sounding so insufferable, and I apologize in advance, and I apologize to everyone who was at singles night that heard this, but I told my origin story of how I met Issa so many times, and then I kept saying as a joke, inspo for you.
That's so annoying. I hate you.
I know. I kept, because I was doing it in a self-deprecatory way, but then it just sounded annoying.
But then it actually sounds like it's not self-deprecating and you're being like, no, we are the pinnacle of long-term love.
I know. And people are like, but how do you do it?
See, I always find that question a weird one when people, like, I think it's really bizarre when people that are in long-term relationships are treated like they've kind of succeeded at something.
Yeah.
It's just luck and chance, a lot of it. Of course you have to work at relationships, but also if you met your person, like that's just good luck. I wouldn't say that me and Marlon have like secrets to a long-term, happy, lasting relationship. I'd be like, I'm just really lucky that I met the love of my life when I did.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Luck, chance.
And on the many times that, you know, you have a massive argument and you're about to break up, one of you walks back across the tube platform and gets back on the tube after threatening to get off at their stop.
I don't think it's some kind of special intel. I don't think that people that make long-term relationships last are somehow in on a secret or cleverer or better at love than anyone else.
Absolutely
I actually
not.
Do just think it's love. However, saying that, I do also, I have to say, there are people, men and women, that are not very good at maintaining long-term relationships.
Some people are really bad.
For their
also,
own reasons in all different ways.
I have to say, some people have unrealistic expectations.
Literally no one is perfect. So I always think with a long-term partner, it's can you put up with their flaws or not?
Absolutely.
And would you rather someone else's flaws or theirs? Which all feels very fitting for this episode, which is a Dolly Alderton special.
Yes. Featuring not Dolly Alderton.
Yes. So for those that don't know and didn't get our piece of homework that we set recently, we are chatting all things Dolly today because her second novel, Good Material, is now out. It was published on the 9th of November. We have thoughts. We're going to go into her whole oeuvre, her first novel, Ghosts, her memoir, Everything I Know About Love. I mean, who didn't love that?
Yes.
A little background on her as a journalist generally. Our number one aspirational icon in journalism for a long time,
absolutely,
wasn't she? We've and looked up to Dolly since we got into journalism.
Since we're little bebes.
She's amazing. We love her. But we also want to get into some various topics of perhaps contention.
Yes, we'll talk about the viral review from the Irish Times that completely annihilated her first novel, Ghosts.
Which was quite shocking to read, I think, at the time, wasn't
yes.
it? Because we just hadn't really seen criticism of Dolly before.
Exactly, and that in itself is an interesting point. We'll also talk about whether she really is the voice of a generation and how maybe how very echo chambery that might feel to many people.
And her issues with it too.
Yep.
But first, shall we go right back to the beginning and give a little debrief on who Dolly Alderton is?
Yes, babes, take it away.
So Dolly Alderton is a 35-year-old writer, author. You may well know her from hit podcast The High-Low. We were obsessed with The High-Low.
Absolutely.
I don't think it would be a secret for anyone to know that The High-Low was one of our big inspos for starting our own podcast and chatting all things pop culture as two women.
Of course.
Dolly herself got her big break when she started as a columnist for the Sunday Times. So she grew up in Stanmore, which is a borough of Harrow, which is North London. So she was born to British and Canadian parents. She describes herself as half Canadian. She was, fun fact guys, don't know how many of you know this, but she was actually born Hannah Alderton and she changed her name to Dolly in her teens. I mean, I think we should take a little pause and talk about that right now, because as someone who clearly has been very savvy about building a personal brand as a writer, says to me that she kind of knew which way her trajectory was going, even as a teenager.
That says to me that she'd thought about her name on the cover of a book before.
Literally that. It feels quite Caroline Calloway, doesn't it?
It does. In fact, Caroline Calloway almost feels like a name that is made up.
I think it was. So I could be wrong. We'll have to go back. Guys, do go and check out our episode with the American author and influencer Caroline Calloway. But I think Calloway is actually, in fact, her maiden name, and she changed it because she knew it would literally look good on the front of the book jacket.
Yes, yes, yes. So you were saying off air, which I think was a really interesting point, was that the fact that Dolly was called Dolly was one of the main pulls of interest for you.
Yeah, so I first discovered Dolly as the Sunday Times style dating columnist. At the back, it was always the last page, and it would be a half and half dating column where she wrote one half and an older man called Cosmo Lansdowne wrote the other. He was in his 60s. He was like thrice divorced.
Yeah.
She was in her 20s. So they had like completely different perspectives on the dating game. And I always saw her as an incredibly aspirational figure, because I was just like, who is this incredibly glamorous 26-year-old with a column in the Sunday Times style, like my pinnacle of publishing at the time. And her name is Dolly. How freaking cool is that? Like, for some reason, it just really played into the mythologization of who she is for me, which obviously was slightly the purpose.
Yes, I think with personal branding and journalism, by the way, guys, for people that don't know, when you begin as a journalist, one of the first things you're told by other journalists is, what's your personal brand? How are you going to market yourself?
Yeah. And I always felt really despondent about that, because I always felt like I just don't have a niche. I'm interested in beauty, but I'm certainly not interested enough in beauty to write about it every day
for
the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I'm interested in fashion, but certainly don't want to be reporting from the catwalks every season for the next 10 years. Like, there's nothing that I would want to focus on with that level of detail.
So I think that was very, very savvy and forward thinking from Dolly.
She obviously did not love the name Hannah.
I think Hannah's a lovely name.
It is, but does Hannah Alderton have quite the zing to it?
Absolutely not. And I also think that you couldn't get your agony column, Dear Dolly. The reason it works is because it's Dear Dolly. Because she's now...
Dear Hannah wouldn't quite be the same, would it?
Because guys, you surely know this if you're interested in Dolly Alderton, but she now has a agony art column in the Sunday Times rather than a dating column.
Yeah. So to go back to her bio, she was educated at St. Margaret's School in Bushey, which I didn't know, but you just mentioned off air is very posh, didn't you?
Yeah.
And then she went to Rugby, which I have heard of because I knew that's super posh.
Also very posh.
Boarding school for sixth form. She got a degree in English and drama from the University of Exeter and a master's degree in journalism from City University.
Well, fun facts, I got rejected.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, that story's really sad. Maybe you should tell the Huns.
I should tell the Huns, because also someone made me feel really embarrassed about it the other day. Someone asked me for advice, a young journalist, and she did a magazine master's at City. And I said to her, oh, I actually got rejected from that. And she looked at me with like absolute shock. I went, but literally everyone gets in.
It did really surprise me that you didn't get in, because you've literally been a massively high achiever your entire life. I remember you describing to me your like submission project, which was Trevor McDonald, no less.
Oh my God, your memory is amazing. Yes, I interviewed Sir Trevor McDonald. Guys, I have to say, look, I have the my application was good. I'm a good writer.
And you've been to sodding Oxford. Literally, what more do they want? And you didn't get in. That shocked me to my core.
Everyone else that applied from Oxford got in. Okay, and this is the worst of it, right? So I applied, got an email inviting me to an interview. I remember being at my desk in third year, being so thrilled, replying, saying, yes, I'm available. Thank you so much. A few hours later, I got...
No, I know what you're going to say, and I'm still dying.
You know those emails where they say, this email has been recalled.
Oh.
And it was like the interview offer had been recalled.
Rescinded.
Yeah, and I was like, sorry. And I emailed to say, sorry, why has this been recalled? And they said, I'm so sorry, Eleanor, but this interview offer was sent to you by accident. I'm afraid you haven't been selected for interview.
I will never get over that. For one, like, why do things like this only happen to you?
Yeah.
It's the most you thing ever. And I can't even put into words why. But something that insane would only happen to you.
Do you know what? I remember I wrote about this in my Substack and I was like, people will think that I'm lying. So I actually included a screenshot of the email.
It's so you. Yeah. Like, it's incredibly, incredibly Ellie Halls, guys. For anyone.
Yes.
If anyone wants to understand.
If anyone wants proof.
Only Ellie would have such a weird thing as for them to literally send the offer and then rescind it. Like, that just doesn't happen. You would think that they would have been so embarrassed. They would have been like, just turn up for interview and then we can just reject you after.
Of course. That's what I was really angry about. I was like, oh my God, just interview
me. Just let her come to the bloody interview now. It's too late.
I'm not so bad that I'm going to be like a monster to interview.
But you know what? I like that you didn't get in because I think it speaks to our very weird little way into the industry that we've both yeah. taken. Neither of us have journalism qualifications. We've both learned on the job.
Saved a hell of a lot of money by not going.
Well, I'd already done a sodding master's. I did an English literature. Well, I did my master was like technically English literature, but it was post-colonial culture and thought. And there was no way I was doing a second fucking master's, like literally no way. Okay, we're getting off track. So yes. We're going to go back to Dolly. But she was, fun fact, especially since we had Georgia Toftafodo on the pod last week, a story producer for Made in Chelsea. Dolly, for those that don't know, guys, always wanted to be a writer, as the name change suggests. And she was writing a blog about being like a kind of 20-something, young 20-something in London. She, off the back of that, got the job story producing for Made in Chelsea. So she was writing storylines for the scripted reality TV yes. show. Lots of love, lots of drama, lots of heartbreak, all quite fitting topics.
Lots of champagne flutes being thrown over a man's face.
Yes. And then, as I mentioned earlier, she began writing for the Sunday Times in 2015, working initially as a dating columnist from 2015 to 2017. So it was around this time for fellow Hilo lovers that Dolly met Pandora. She met her just before she started at the Times. And I actually was reticent to bring this up on the podcast because I can't fact check it because it's in the depths of the Hilo archive. However, I'm fairly certain that it was Pandora that got Dolly the gig at the Times. I'm sure she's mentioned that in a previous episode.
So Pandora was at this point wardrobe's mistress.
Exactly. She was the wardrobe mistress who, for those that don't remember, was basically the page in the style supplement where the wardrobe mistress would be the, I suppose, sartorial agony aunt and would try on all different things based on people's questions.
Exactly.
Pandora and Dolly met through a friend who had set them up on a platonic date.
Not
because
that.
She thought that they would get on. How cute. I mean, anyone listening out there, if you've got any platonic date ideas for us, we will gratefully receive.
I would like to go on a platonic date.
I've never been on a platonic date and I feel like it would be really fun.
Have you even been on a date?
Would you like to know the first date I ever went on? And this is ridiculous tangents and I'm going to say it very quickly and then we will stop. Weirdly, the first date I ever went on in my life was to We Will Rock You the Musical.
Cathars.
I know.
A little bit more in detail, please.
So random.
Why?
Because my friend like met this guy that she liked and I think he'd been a doorman at a club or something. I remember his claim to fame. This is actually hilarious. He was... obviously like, on the side, he was an actor, which is why they took us to this musical. And he'd been in a Pendulum, you know, remember Pendulum, that like dance act? He'd been in one
yes,
of the music
but
videos.
Yes, he loves Pendulum.
Yeah, that was like this guy's claim to fame. My friend wanted to go out with him. So she and he set up this plan for us to go on a double date with me and this other friend.
So how old are you? Pendulum, that was when we were about 18.
I was about 17. We were underage and we had to obviously lie about the whole thing because the whole thing was that we'd met them on this club circuit and we were pretending that we were like 19 when we were clearly like 17, 16. And
the pimping of underage women at the London club circuit.
Exactly.
Absolute
that.
Absolute disgraceful.
And then, yeah, but then they took us to bloody We Will Rock You. And I was like, this feels very camp and not
did
much like
snog?
A
did you snog?
No.
Did like, you try to?
No.
Was there not even a bit of heavy petting?
No.
Not a hand on the knee?
And we went to All Bar One first.
No.
How awful is that? All Bar One and then We Will Rock You. What a bloody weird day.
Cathars, may I remind you that 2 years ago we went to All Bar One before the Brits.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with Allbar One in the Millennium Dome. Yeah. I'm literally always at that fucking Allbar One.
I love the Cosmos at Allbar One.
To get a drink. I mean, you know me, I always get a pint. But really, I must bring this back on track.
I'm so sorry.
Sorry, guys. We're also really trying to be strict with our recording time today, so...
Another time, I will tell you about my date, which is...
Go on. You're going to have to mention it now. It feels fitting. It's Dolly relevant.
Guys, allow it. Dolly loves the tangent. My first date was when I was 18. It was at the Slug and Lettuce Wimbledon.
Chic. And
it was
stylish.
Mostly silent because the man was Italian and spoke no English.
Again, very you.
And then my second ever date was at Westfields, and it was...
A shopping date.
And we spent the whole time shopping for the guy's grandma and mother's Christmas present. And then that was it.
Well, to be fair to you, at that time, we weren't, like, dating wasn't really a thing. Like, men of our age, I would say men, they were clearly boys. Like, 16-year-old boys weren't taking you on dates, you know? So that was my first, even though I'd, like, had, you know, like, experience with boys at that point in my life, the first date was the theatre because no one of my age would have ever taken me out anywhere at all.
So... the second date I went on, the guy was 20. He really should have known better.
And how old were you? 16?
18. I was at uni.
Not too bad.
And I remember he was like,
go with that.
Let's go to the champagne bar in Westfields. And I was like, okay, if you're
That's
paying.
That's a weird date spot.
And he didn't pay.
And also, like in hindsight again, when you're, oh, this cool 20-year-old, the champagne bar in Westfield, what a bloody weird date spot.
Are you having a laugh?
Like, are you high? That's like suggesting going to St. Pancras and going to the Fortnum and Mason.
Absolutely, I was in shock.
But at the time, you probably thought it was chic. Like no. I said, at the time, I thought going to We Will Rock You was like incredibly grown up and glamorous.
See, at the time, I was like, how dare you bring me along with your fucking Christmas admin? Just because I'm a woman and I know what to get your grandma.
You want me to do your Christmas shopping for you?
Buy me the champagne. Anyway, we digress.
Back to Dolly's chronology.
Yes.
Where it really gets interesting, and where I'm sure many of our listeners will be picking up along the tail, was in 2016 when Dolly and Pandora started a podcast that was for the Sunday Times Style called the Pandolly Podcast.
I mean, can I just say, in terms of just memorable names, Dolly Alderton and Pandora Sykes.
It's so memorable.
If Kathleen only,
and Ellen doesn't Kathleen have quite the same ring to it, does it, unfortunately?
No.
And I notice now how even people, when they talk on blogs and stuff about them, everyone calls Pandora Panda still, like a cute little nickname, which I always found really cute. But anyway, the High Low, as people probably know, ran for 4 years. So both women left the Sunday Times and then the High Low went out on its own. I think it was a really shock success. I mean, I know they were very popular women and they also had quite good, I guess, I don't want to devalue their literary skills, but almost like influencing platforms in that they were both quite big on Instagram at the time.
Yeah.
Pandora had started a fashion blog, like she started as a fashion blogger. So her outfit pics, I remember that's why I started following her.
But also they leveraged, because of the Pandolly podcast, you're broadcasting already to hundreds of thousands of listeners through the Sunday Times subscribers.
Yeah.
And then they managed to carry those over.
And I remember you saying to me when you used to do that, like always take notes writers podcast.
Oh my God, Lord.
When you interviewed Pandora.
Yes, I went to her house.
Yeah, which in 1 second you must give some sneaky intel to the listeners on.
I wish you had been there on my shoulder.
But you told me that she mentioned in that interview that it was never non-monetized. Like from day one of the High Low, because it was already a successful brand in itself from the Pandolly podcast, the High Low hit the ground running.
Yes, and I remember that's how I first started. Well, we both started reaching out to sponsors. As we've always said, guys, we always reach out to our own sponsors for Show Up, was because I read.
You asked them, what do you do?
And I asked Pandora during that interview with Always Take Notes, what did you do? And I remember her saying, like, we cold emailed hundreds of brands, and that's how they got Mac right from the go.
Yeah.
And they would, cold email these brands and get bespoke sponsorship deals, which is what we do.
So thanks, guys.
Thanks
for your
tips.
So post the High Low, which as mentioned, ended in 2020 with a live show special, both women went on to do their own thing. Dolly had been incredibly successful at this point because when she was 28, she wrote Everything I Know About Love, her best-selling, internationally acclaimed memoir. I think it sold 800,000 copies, which in publishing is wild.
It is.
And that made her a household name.
So quick thoughts on that memoir. I loved it.
I absolutely loved it. And to this day, it's probably my favorite thing she's ever done.
Absolutely. I think she just, well, I think we'll get into this at some point, but I think there is a bit of nuance we need to have around that memoir, because I think what happened was with that memoir, she then became proclaimed as the voice of a generation.
Yes.
The Nora, the millennial Nora Ephron. And I think we have to be quite careful, because I think a lot of people do not feel that they relate.
No, absolutely. However, not. I would say that the people that she appeals to are the ones that do. So, like, would you even read Everything I Know About Love if you weren't going to enjoy the nostalgic references to MSN and to like UFO cargo pants and house parties and grotty student life? If you feel alienated from that world, like, would you even enjoy the book? I think not.
And I think there's probably those people that if you mentioned Dolly Alderton, they wouldn't even know who she was.
Yes.
And wouldn't have years ago.
It's for a very certain demographic, isn't it? And that's what I actually liked about the book. It really does encapsulate what it was like growing up in like the 90s and early noughts.
And I think Dolly's USP is the warmth and vulnerability of her writing and the comic levity of a lot of what she, and that's why I find it, I mean I think a lot of people have written about that, right? Like, it's not like new territory.
It's not, but I'd never read anything prior to Everything I Know About Love that quite so perfectly encapsulated that like millennial woman British experience, particularly on the whole like grotty student lifestyle.
Middle class millennial.
Very
women.
Middle class, yes.
I think that's all we need to make clear.
Really important. Like,
For me, it's always been like the style of her writing rather than necessarily even what she's saying. Apart, because I guess me and you have never actually been able to relate to all the dating stuff, because we never dated in our 20s, really.
Okay, guys, so hopefully you already know this, but here at Straight Up, we actually reach out to every single sponsor that we work with all ourselves, meaning that when you hear a recommendation like this one, we have cherry-picked the brand based on products that we already use and really, really want to share with you all. Also with a discount code, of course.
Yeah, we would never advertise something that we don't already love. And Adaptogenic Coffee has been perhaps our favourite discovery of the past year. It took trying a few different brands, but since we found London Nootropics, we've never looked back. They're three different, very tasty blends, all boost brain health while actively and noticeably helping with focus, reducing anxiety, boosting energy, memory, and more.
So just to explain adaptogens and nootropics a little bit, they are natural ingredients like medicinal mushrooms that really improve mental well-being and change how you feel when you consume them. London Nootropics Zen Blend, for example, which is their most balancing blend, contains award-winning ashwagandha in the highest concentration, as well as premium CBD. It is the absolute dream for when you're feeling stressed. The adaptogens in all the blends, actually, by the way, as well, counteract the usual jitters and crashes that you might get from regular coffee. Zen, though, is particularly soothing. I always get really quite anxious the morning after drinking alcohol, but a sachet of Zen now sorts me right out.
It really does make you feel so alert, calm, and focused. I have to say, I was a bit skeptical before actually trying adaptogens myself, but now I cannot imagine starting the morning without a cup of London Nootropics Adaptogenic Coffee. We can't wait to hear what you all think as well. Head to londonnootropics.co.uk and enter the code straight up at the checkout for 20% off. That's straight up, all one word, no caps. Since then, she then wrote her novel Ghost, which we'll go into later. And then she turned Everything I Know About Love into a BBC show starring Belle Powley, which was brilliant.
Emma Appleton as Maggie, who's the kind of Dolly character.
She was
Belle
great.
Powley's the bestie. Can I just say as a side note, did you know that Belle Powley is married to the actor Douglas Booth? The wedding pictures were doing the round the other week, and I had no idea they were a couple.
No, Belle Powley is forever in my heart and mind be Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging.
She's great. I actually really like her. I think she's a really good actress.
Yeah.
And I read her whole wedding coverage piece. It was very cute. Douglas Booth, he's quite a handsome chap.
Yeah, he is, isn't he? Yeah, I loved that show. It was brilliant.
So I think everyone loved it. It's been a runaway success. It was really big in America as well. It was a kind of collaboration between Peacock and the BBC. But to go back to the kind of timeline that we were on before, it was from the high low that Dolly left to do the adaptation of Everything I Know About Love.
Yes. I think it got to a point where the high low got so big that neither Pandora nor Dolly could balance her personal private projects anymore.
Yeah. And if you want to know a little bit more about that, you can actually go and listen to our old episode with Pandora, where we ask her all about why they decided to tie up the high low. But in part, I think it was just that they both wanted to get on with other projects.
Yeah.
So Dolly was going... I think Dolly also always wanted to be a scriptwriter.
I think it made a lot of sense. I was really sad when it ended. It felt like a weird friendship breakup. And I think there was a lot of like...
What happened?
Have they had a fight? Because of course everyone has to like gossip like that. But no, they just... I think they got you want to end on a high.
And they'd said that they were always really strict about that. When they'd begun it, they'd said it will be 4 years. And that's it. And then we'll do other things.
They did it very well.
Also, I will say they were coming to it from a different position, as we've discussed, with lots of podcasts take years and years and years to build on a grassroots level, whereas they started on a high.
Yeah.
So you can see 4 years of big success. Like, it's not like they had years of building and then it was like suddenly really big and it was only big for a year or whatever. It was actually huge for the full 4 year run, really.
And I think what was interesting, I think they're both sensitive. Pandora in particular had talked to us about how sensitive she was, and she's talked about this in interviews as well. I don't think she could deal anymore with the level of scrutiny that podcast was giving both of them.
Yeah, they were getting a million listeners a month, and I just think they felt they couldn't do right for doing wrong. That's the overall feeling that I got. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think particularly with women in the public eye, and this is a very complicated issue, but essentially the tide turns. Suddenly they get too successful, or they've had it for too long, and they've had too much love,
like it.
And people turn.
Completely. I think that's exactly what happened with Dolly and Pandora. They were like the pinnacle of female journalism. And then suddenly the high-low did so well that people started to get bitter. And I do think, you know, when you have a big audience, you are always going to say things that people don't like. That's part of putting your head above the parapet. Like, it will get shot off. However, we did touch on this off air.
Yeah.
As huge high-low stands, we have to say we did feel that they became a little bit...
on the fence.
On the fence, exactly.
And I totally empathise, and I'm sorry to say...
I get why they did, completely.
I think we probably would do the same.
Yeah, if I had literally constant barrage of abuse about my points on everything. And when we have had... So, full disclosure, guys, we very rarely get negative feedback, but when we do, it is like a big deal. Like, you don't just brush it off as a nothingness comment.
No.
Like, it feels like, oh my God, we failed our audience in some way. Even if it's just a flippant comment that someone's picked up on and no one else has.
And I'm so glad we're in it as a pair, because if it was me on my own, I'd have a nervous breakdown.
Oh my God, it'd be so awful.
I mean, the other day, we've had a negative comment. I mean, I think we've had two negative comments.
Ever,
which is so sweet. But we'll get more, as we get bigger, we'll get way more. And that's something we've got to reconcile ourselves with.
That's part of it.
But they really freak me out. And I don't think I could deal with it on a personal level in the like hundreds.
Yes.
And actually what I really noticed, and I think this is again a massive issue with the way people troll women in the spotlight, if you looked at the old high-low reviews, it got really personal the way they tried to divide Dolly and Pandora by picking out who was better at what, who had their weird little tics.
And like whether they were team Pandora or team Dolly.
Yeah.
Or which feels really counterintuitive. And actually no wonder they felt ready to like professionally separate if people were constantly going to compare you. I mean, I have to be really careful about this. I think especially with women, people always kind of devalue their contributions by... through comparison, but I was tempted, and I'm now not going to do it, to make a comparison between Dolly's book and Pandora's. And actually I had to catch myself, because I was like, why am I associating them as even relevant to one another? Like, one is a collection of essays and one's a novel. So why am I trying to compare them in my own head about whose is better or whose is worse? Like, actually that should be irrelevant.
Yeah. And they were very different. And that's what I always love about like dynamic duos. And that's what I think works with us, babe, is that we are quite different.
Yes, you don't want two people that are just cookie cutter versions of one another.
No.
Otherwise you could just have one of them.
And they were quite, exactly. Yeah. And they were quite different, which is great. But yeah, as Katha says, where I think the podcast lost its initial sparkle and when it needed to end was when they became too scared to share opinions,
and things had to be very scripted because they were obviously being so careful about what they were saying.
That's the thing, it's a constant struggle. Like, you have a massive responsibility to a lot of people listening, but ultimately you've got to have fresh, unique opinions, otherwise why would they listen?
Yeah, and I totally see why Dolly wanted to move on to something else.
Yeah,
in fact, in her Sunday Times interview with Annie Lord, one of our favourite writers on Heartbreak. We've mentioned her quite a few times recently,
guys. We love her memoir, Notes on Heartbreak.
Yeah, she's the Vogue dating columnist, and she approaches Heartbreak in a really fresh, interesting, funny way that we love. So definitely go check her out. But in that interview, Dolly talks about how she felt this kind of shift, I guess, professionally, where she wanted to move away from this focus on her self and her personal brand. So when talking about Good Material, her new book, which, by the way, for those that don't know, it centers on Andy, a 35-year-old, averagely successful comedian. He's been with Jen, who works in insurance, for 3 years, 10 months and 29 days before she breaks up with him, which is the opening of the book, and the whole book charts his year post-heartbreak. So on that point, Dolly said, I wanted to write about someone who couldn't be compared to me. I'd spent my 20s writing about my sex and dating life every week in a column, posting pictures of myself on a daily walk or with my flatmates. And I had this growing feeling that it didn't serve me anymore. I felt out of control. With my career, social media was stressful and the conversations around me were stressful. I started with this therapist when I was 30 and she said to me, the way you're living, with your career, who you are, some people could carry on like this, but you can't. You're not robust enough for people to know all about your private life on this scale. What got you here won't get you there.
Very, very interesting. And I so empathize with that.
Yeah, she probably just got to the point where she was like, I'm sick of mining my personal life for my professional content.
So before we get into good material, I think we should discuss this because particularly as a journalist and an editor, I am so sensitive to this as someone who commissions young women and women generally to not exploit their personal lives and to be very careful and to have a real duty of care around what you're asking people to share and whether they're going to regret it later down the line. And whether it's worth the realistically very low fees. Like, are you going to talk about an abortion you had for 200 quid?
Yeah. It's a real difficult position that writers are put in because your personal life is supposed to be mined for ideas. But it is a real ethical conundrum. Like you say, there are stories that you might feel comfortable telling in your early 20s that 10 years later you wish weren't in the public realm.
And I think whenever I read people talk about this, they always say, I'm so glad I did share it because I connected with so many people over it. And I still, my most personal pieces are the ones that get the most messages from random women. And that sense of community and like the power of sharing and normalizing taboo things is so important.
And that's my favorite type of journalism. Absolutely. They're the pieces I want to read.
Absolutely. But the reason that there's a reason why confessional journalism is commissioned so much is because it does the best in terms of online performance and does page views. There's a reason why editors definitely gravitate around it. It's easy. It's quick. You can write 800 words.
Doesn't need much fact checking.
No. It's lowest paid because it's the least word count.
Also, and, like, as human beings, we're just nosy. And so I think it taps into that base level desire that we have to know about other people's lives. I mean, I remember, so I want to use her Instagram handle, but, you know, Sophie Wilkinson? Wilkogram?
Yes, yeah.
So who's actually one of Dolly Alderton's very good friends. She is a well-known journalist, for those that don't know. She posted around the time of the Sarah Everard anti-police protests about, do you remember there was the iconic picture of the redhead woman who was like on the floor?
Yes, this is so interesting what happened with this.
Yeah, she wrote a first person piece for The Independent being like, I was that woman. And Sophie Wilkinson did this whole post about like, this is extremely irresponsible commissioning. And she's not a journalist either, first and foremost.
Yes, that really backfired. She got so much shit for that. Because everyone was like, oh, you're making it all about you instead of Sarah Everard. And it's like, well, no, I got asked.
See, I didn't even know there was a backlash to the piece.
But then I also saw a backlash from general people who just thought, why is this woman positioning herself as like the figurehead of the Sarah Everard travesty?
Yeah, and now like, not that that's a negative thing to be part of course it's not. We know that's massively positive, but that will now follow that woman to every job interview, to every chance meeting she has.
Do you know what it was? It was because she was an aspiring actress. And so people thought that she was exploiting it to further her acting profile.
Interesting.
But again, this is the whole point. And it's literally,
this is why it's such a flaw issue.
Yeah. It's literally called the first person industrial complex because it's so common. And I really recommend you read a Substack. It's free to read. You just type in Substack, Frankie de la Cretaz. I really hope I pronounced that right.
I'm going to guess you didn't, but that's okay.
Frankie de la Cretaz. And the Substack is called Out of Your League. And it talks about, and I'm laughing kind of like blackly, they talk about how much it was difficult for their first published byline at Cosmo to be an essay titled What It's Like to Have Genital Herpes When You're Pregnant.
Like, no, not for me. I could never, ever, ever publish something like that.
Yeah, and says, I got $50.
$50? Yeah. For that?
Said, I popped out 1,200 word essays for $50 a pop. I'd write them in less than an hour.
I mean, for less than an hour's work, not too shabby. I suppose that's the thing. Personal writing is literally quicker and easier to do, but the long-term impact is worse.
And what this writer makes clear as well is that the people are particularly at risk of exploitation and marginalised voices because they are the ones that desperately need bylines.
And they feel like they have to like mine their stories of
absolutely
being subjugated or related to trauma. And I think that's where it's really problematic, as you say. Yeah, and I think it's one thing if your personal journalism is based around really rather inane topics, like Pandora, I remember, wrote a lot about her hungry bum. And it was about having a big bum that you'd like get wedgies in. As in, not to belittle her writing, but that's just silly and funny and you're never going to really regret
it. Well, I remember reading it and being like, that just means you have a great arse and I wish
yeah,
I had it.
Yeah, and I'm like, does that really warrant an entire think piece? But okay, I mean, people are very imaginative.
So I should say, hungry bum because they swallowed her thongs.
Yes. Yeah. That's why I said she had a wedgie all the time.
Oh, that's basically what it was. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's fine. But when it comes to marginalized voices basically having to mine their trauma for the entertainment of others, I think that's really problematic.
Yes,
but, and it's really unfair that especially those that have had those experiences, minority voices, feel like the only way in is to be subjugated within the narrative.
Absolutely. So there's a real issue with first-person journalism. So I totally get why Dolly suddenly
wants
felt
to move away from
like
that.
She wanted to move away. And we felt like that, right, babe? Like, I have definitely clammed up when it comes to first-person journalism. I used to do it.
I mean, I've never been a first-person journalist.
You've never done that,
I've always felt uncomfortable with it because basically as well, I think all the interesting first-person journalism that I would want to do, every single story actually in some way includes another person and in a way that I don't feel it's appropriate ethically for me to write about that person.
Well, actually, one of my... Oh, it's difficult. So Sunday Times Star commissioned me to write this piece called Generation Mute. It was my first piece. I was so proud of it because it was my first byline beyond GQ.
Can I just say, guys, it was genuinely an amazing piece.
Basically, guys, the background is that my friend had died in a horrible freak accident. And we would have been early 20s. And we were in that phase of our lives where no one called each other ever. Like, it was someone started calling you, like when my friend did to tell me my friend had been killed...
You knew something was wrong.
Something very bad was happening. And I just remembered when he died, no one called each other and it was so weird. It was just like people would send like emojis on WhatsApp. And I was like, what is this breakdown of communication that is happening within our generation? I desperately need to talk to someone on the phone. And I wasn't reaching out to them and they weren't reaching out. I mean, I'm not saying people were to blame. We were all in this kind
of... in the same way.
Yeah, generation mute. And I wrote about it. And then and I was really proud that I wrote about it and I'm still don't regret the piece. But two things happened when I wrote it. One, then I couldn't get people to stop calling me. And it was like, actually, I don't want everyone calling me. Be like, how are you, Elle?
Just checking in.
Yeah.
Can you not check in?
But I think everyone was a bit like, why did you write a piece about it? Couldn't you just tell us?
Yeah.
I think they were a bit like, what a funny way to find out about your best friend being annoyed that you're not calling them. Why didn't you just tell me?
Newspaper supplement.
Which totally fair, right? Why did I write it instead of telling them? I guess because I was trying to communicate a message beyond my friendship group, right? That is why, but still weird. And secondly, my friend's parents read it and I hadn't warned them.
Oh, okay.
Obviously, I didn't name him or anything.
No, no. But how did they feel about it? Did they find it a positive that you were using it as an opportunity to talk about community and connection with young people and grief, bereavement, or were they like, you could have asked us?
No, they didn't comment either way. And I'm still really close to them. And it was never an issue. It was more, I just remember they just mentioned it like, oh, we didn't know you were going to write.
And actually that made you feel a bit funny because you're like, oh, you're reading about your own personal tragedy in a newspaper.
Exactly. And I think basically, and I think Dolly has said this before as well, you need to seek consent. If you're going to talk about people's tragedy or their son or whatever, in my case it was the parent's son, you just have to either let them know. I don't think I needed to ask for permission because it was very much my it wasn't about
Detail in terms of what had happened to their son.
No names, nothing, no details of the accident, absolutely not. But it would have been nice to let them know.
Yes. I think it's only once you're a little bit older and with hindsight that you can even think that.
Exactly. And also, once you raise your profile in that way as a personal journalist, you have to keep maintaining it. It is like something you have to keep feeding. You can't just write one personal piece and that's it.
Well, one thing to go back to Dolly, I thought was really interesting with Everything I Know About Love, and you and I have discussed this before, was how her friend Farley felt about her personal tragedy, which was her sister, Florence, passing away young from blood cancer, who was also a very good friend of Dolly's, being a narrative center in the book. Obviously, you can very much tell that Dolly has dealt with it in the most beautifully sensitive, nuanced, careful way, where she very clearly has the family's permission. And in fact, as mentioned earlier, the finale live show of the Hilo raised money specifically for blood cancer, which was a cause close to both of their hearts.
I listened to a recent episode of Dolly being interviewed on Shameless, and the way Dolly, sadly, another one of her friends is going through something, is very, very ill. And she breaks down. She starts crying on the episode. And I was jogging and I had to stop and like cry, because the way she is able, and I think this is what is Dolly's USP, the way she is able to so beautifully put through these like universal feelings, no matter where you're from, just about grief and love and friendship, into these amazing, heartfelt, vulnerable little odes.
She's so accessible.
Yes.
And I don't, and I mean that in the best sense of the word. Like, she really does understand the human condition.
It's that. And I think there is a massive issue with Dolly Alderton being seen as a voice of a generation when it's very much a middle class experience. But in terms of more universal feelings like grief and love and female friendship, I think that is universal.
Oh, bang on every time, isn't she? These little truisms that infiltrate her work, and they're almost when you least expect it.
Absolutely. And actually, I will say, one of my, I think I prefer to listen to Dolly than I even do to read her. I think she is so good.
She's so wise.
With the spoken, she is such a good storyteller, and she has such a lovely voice.
And so eloquent.
It was so warm.
Yes.
There was a warmth to her that felt like, basically, when you listen to Dolly on an episode, it's like getting a big hug.
And you want her to be your best friend.
You want her to be her best. So why is it? So what is this obsession with Dolly as, because I would, wouldn't you say, Cass, it's quite amazing and quite unusual how a journalist can parlay her work into that kind of fan base. I don't know any other writer, journalist, who has that kind of fandom. She has like almost 400,000 followers on Instagram. Writers don't get
She's
famous.
The most famous. I think we talked about this with Caroline O'Donoghue, didn't we? Like, she is a celebrity, and that's unusual.
A celebrity writer. Very unusual.
And she does have a aura about her. Like, when I've seen her at events, she's got the golden glow of a famous person.
She does.
That magnetism.
I mean, thank God she changed her name to Dolly, because Hannah would be too boring a name.
It wouldn't work.
She's so stately. Is that a compliment? I mean, it's a compliment. Like, because she's so tall and she's got amazingly bright blonde hair and amazing skin and blue eyes.
Uh-huh, she's like a supermodel.
Yeah, she's got such presence.
So in terms of the voice of a generation thing, the Annie Lord Times piece touches on exactly what you mentioned earlier, with this weird trend that tends to happen when women reach a certain level of acclaim.
Yeah.
So in the beginning, the woman does brilliant work. Everyone loves it. She's the voice of a generation. Then she gets more traction. Then people get sick of hearing about it. They say it's overrated. They say they get angry and say it doesn't represent all women. Everyone starts disliking it and then becomes fixated on another woman who's done another thing. And so it continues. And she points out how it's happened to Lena Dunham and to a lesser extent, Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yes.
So Dolly herself responds to this. She's asked how she feels about being called the voice of a generation. And she says, I don't like people foisting these sorts of titles on me, suggesting that I represent millennial women or anything generational. That makes me feel very uncomfortable. It's flattering, but it's not something I set out to do.
Which is so fair.
So fair. I think it's way too much of a kind of albatross to be considered the voice of a generation. Who the hell actually wants that? Like, yes, in theory, that's every writer's dream. But when it actually comes to it, it's too much pressure.
And I have to say, I agree. Dolly has never set out to put her position herself in that way.
No, she's uniquely herself, and she's actually incredibly odd. Like, that sounds rude. I don't mean it in that way, but not many 30-something-year-old women are deeply obsessed with Rod Stewart.
No, she's got very...
She has niche interests.
Really niche. And I think she had no idea that Everything I Know About Love would become so successful.
No, it was just true to her. And actually, I told you this earlier, but she talks about how the casting director of the TV adaptation of Everything I Know About Love kind of cracked the code of casting for that show when she realized that the group of girls, who are of course meant to be Dolly and her friends, she's realized, oh, these girls are all dweebs. They grow up in the suburbs, regional towns. They are funny and attractive in their own way and popular with each other, but they are not cool at all. And Dolly says that that was so important to her as part of the show. Like, she isn't ever trying to be like the mainstream hun.
No, you know? She is not down with the kids.
No.
She is an old soul.
Yes.
So then her debut novel was Ghosts in 2020. You read it and liked it, didn't you, Cass?
I did. I find it really enjoyable. Although I will say, again, this is not so much a criticism as an observation. We talked about this when I mentioned Monica Heisey's book, Really Good Actually, which is all about a 20-something divorcee. But it's a clearly kind of thinly veiled personal experience tale. I know you mentioned when we discussed Monica Heisey's book that writers tend to rely on personal experience for their debut. Absolutely. Actually, I would totally do that. I mean, what else are you going to write about? You're going to like pull out of thin air.
Exactly.
Ghosts, for those that haven't read it, centres on Nina Dean, who is a journalist. She's a food writer in this instance. Very successful, living in North London, I think, as well, at the time Dolly was living in Camden.
Yeah.
And she is on the dating scene. As the title would suggest, she has an experience of being ghosted.
Yes. So you liked it. I have to say, I didn't love it. I loved everything I know about love, and I loved the Pilo. And I mean, we know I love everything about Dolly, but I couldn't get into it. I felt like I was reading a memoir disguised as a novel, and there was it kind of fell between the cracks and between those.
Yes. Whereas Everything I Know About Love being actually a memoir felt deeply intimate and true.
Absolutely. I couldn't really buy into the characters. For me, characters, everything. And if I don't fundamentally believe that these are real flesh and blood, I lose interest. But you know, I lose interest with a lot of books. As we know, I just gave up on Zadie Smith's The Fraud. And I think Zadie Smith is one of the best novelists ever. So.
And I will say with Ghosts, it was very much one of those books, we've touched on this quite a lot before, but the kind of millennial female novelist in London, like there's quite a blueprint almost to those stories now.
Yes. Cathers, we have many pet peeves that unite us, but I must say one of the most notable has got to be our misophonia, which, as we've recently discovered, is the term used to describe a negative emotional reaction to common sounds.
Oh my God, babe, nothing enrages us quite like the sound of someone frothing at their desk or tapping away violently on their keyboard. For me, as someone that struggles with ADHD, distracting sounds are honestly such an issue when I'm trying to work. I actually can't cope.
Of course. Which is why we're such big fans of the tiny, comfy and super unobtrusive Karma earbuds from our brilliant podcast sponsor, Flare Audio. Cathers, how do they work? Take it away.
Well, huns, our ears are shaped like shells, so the sound we receive is always distorted at about 20%. Most people's brains filter that out, but if, like me and Elle's, yours needs a little bit of a helping hand, then the Karma earbuds are just perfect.
Such an upgrade, I have to say, from my noise-cancelling headphones, which are very antisocial when you're in the office and a colleague's trying to talk to you and block you off from sounds you actually really need to hear. Don't just take our word for it either, guys. They've sold 2 million pairs since the launch of lockdown, and they even do mini versions for kids and a new version called Karma Soft, which is an extra soft option for those with more sensitive ears.
And the extra, extra good news is that Flare Audio has 20% off site-wide right now. It's for Black Friday, so go to flareaudio.com to snap up your Karma earbuds for just $15.96 instead of the usual $19.95.
Thank you so much to Flare. I think there comes a point where there is, we've talked about this before, a saturation of white middle-class women talking about what it's like to be a white middle-class woman in
London. Also happens to be a writer by trade.
Yeah. And it's just a bit of an echo chamber. And actually, I am gagging for different stories, which is why, and we must talk about it, I am loving Tomorrow, Tomorrow, Tomorrow.
Yay!
Because it's about a completely different industry, different perspective. And it's why we loved Yellowface as well, even though it's about publishing. Anyway, but so, Ghosts was very positively reviewed.
Some places.
Except for one review, which went viral simply because no one had dared criticise Dolly Alderton before.
I'm not going to lie, and I will hold my hands up, and this is me being really vulnerable with you guys, because it's not something that I'm proud of. I did have some schadenfreude reading that review, just because I was so shocked that anyone would dare to bring down the great Dolly Alderton.
I was thrilled, not in a positive way, just thrilled as in, oh my God, something deeply new is happening.
Yeah, as in I felt really sorry for her reading the review, because as we will go on to quote in a moment, it is flipping harsh, but it did feel refreshing. Like, I see why the review itself went viral.
Yes, I think as people that work in journalism, we've talked about this before, there is such an echo chamber when it comes to opinion. People are so scared to write or say what they think, and totally fair enough, because you get trolled for differing from the status quo a lot of the time. And I have empathy with that, because that's happened to me. And, you know, there's a reason I personally don't even write music reviews anymore, because I'm so fucking scared of the stands and everyone else. So I totally empathize with why voicing your opinion online is really frightening, particularly, and I think actually this is something we must say, as a young journalist reviewing a book by the mighty Dolly Alderton, you don't want to get blackballed from the industry.
I would have been like, I loved it, even if I didn't, because I would have felt like it was so radically unacceptable to say you hate Dolly Alderton's book. Not that I did. As I said, I actually did love it, but it definitely wouldn't have been a kind of acceptable opinion at the time to say you hate
it. As a young writer, you would have assumed that if you did that, your career would be over.
Yeah.
You would be blackballed. Yeah. Not by Dolly, because I actually think Dolly Alderton, and I've heard her talk about this before, is very sanguine when it comes to bad press.
She is. And one thing, again, I keep quoting it, but it was a brilliant interview, the Annie Lord Times interview. She talks about negative reviews there, and she references a very funny scenario where there was a rude review by Liz Jones. I mean, she absolutely tore it to shreds. She hated it. And she had written in the review, "Dolly is so attractive. I can't imagine her ever struggling to get a boyfriend." And Dolly said, and I quote, "My publishing team were like, this is so offensive. And all I could think is," she touches her chest in mock pleasure, "people think I'm attractive."
Yeah, see, that's like, so great.
That's so why I love Dolly, because absolutely, that is what you would think. You'd be like, I've just been trashed, but oh my God, there is
they
a
think
smile.
I'm hot.
Like,
oh,
it's such like basic humanity that's so true and so
and she's
real.
So unafraid to reveal that.
To just be honest.
And so this, I make the point that actually I think Dolly very much would be totally cool with a bad review. I mean, obviously it would affect her like it would anyone, but she would certainly not try and blacklist a young journalist for being critical with her work. But I do think that it would get them a bad reputation in the industry. And thus, I personally, and in fact, someone did ask me to review Ghosts for The Telegraph, and I said no.
I think that was probably sensible if I didn't enjoy it.
Well, I hadn't even read it yet, but I was like, regardless.
It's
too much of a responsibility.
Yeah, it is.
You
it
know.
Really is. I mean, I will say, and again, you must read some of these quotes. He was called Barry something, right? The writer. He's a young writer.
Yes.
And I think, though, there is an element of he was getting a little bit of delight and joy out of tearing
absolutely
down a literary juggernaut.
A literary icon. So guys, I'm going to read out some of these quotes, not to add to the pain that no doubt this review gave, because it's so mean, but just because I think it's important to know the context. Okay, so Barry Pierce, he's from Cork Island. He's 27 years old now, according to his bio. He now works for the fashion magazine Hero and Heroine. He also has a books column in The Big Issue. So when he wrote this, he must have been 24. And he, some of his quotes include the following. "Alderton's skewering of dating apps surely makes Ghosts the most culturally relevant novel of 2014. If that's lost on anyone, it was published in 2020. That's the joke. Her novels, barbs and biting observations are as succinct as the tweets they were all recycled from."
Oh, so bitchy, this review, isn't it? Bloody. I think that's why I found it so shocking at the time, because I'd just never read anything quite so openly bitchy.
It's quite old school in terms of hatchet jobs, for anyone that doesn't know. We, as journalists, we were always told, like, oh, it's a hatchet job. And I remember when we first started GQ, I was like, what does this mean?
Who is hatchet?
Yeah. And it's basically, it's a takedown. Yeah. And it's a cheap takedown. Yeah. Okay, carrying on. "It's a rehashed version of You Got Mail without the charm, wit or timelessness. Her prose is thick like mayonnaise. I felt like the Alec Guinness character in The Bridge on the River Kwai." And guys, I had to look up the background to this. It's so mean. But basically, the film Bridge on the River Kwai is about British prisoners of war forced to build a bridge on the Burma-Siam Railway during World War II. And it's Alec Guinness's character plays a British colonel who, because his sense of duty and pride in his work is so great, that even though he's a prisoner of war forced to build this bridge for his Japanese captors, he can't help but build a brilliant bridge because he feels he has to do his work well. And I think, and Barry is comparing himself to that character.
Right.
Because he has to finish the book and write about it as a sense of duty, but he feels
but
like a prisoner of
like
war.
Like being
in World War II. I mean, it's a bit much. And the last line is actually not even about Dolly, but it's very funny. And you quoted it to me the other day, babe.
I could remember it. I haven't read that piece for like 4 years.
Oh, yeah,
that line has stayed. No, because I'm going to butcher it.
Okay, fine.
But it's like the general gist of it, because it was so hilariously, outrageously mad.
It's a bit maverick.
It's always stuck in my mind.
So it's, "In a few moments, I will grab my keening shawl and set off into the blackness. Whether I return or not is a question for the wind."
Because basically the hint in the piece is that Dolly is such a beloved writer that someone's going to take him out for writing this.
And certainly he was on the internet assassinated. So it was really interesting what happened. So the piece went viral. There were two sides. There was one side, I think, of old school journalists who kind of breathed a sigh of relief and were like, thank God someone is being honest. Criticism is not dead. We can be real. Yes, the novel wasn't that good. Then there was this other backlash that was like, that review is so self-indulgent and is just cruel for the sake of being cruel. Oh,
I see both sides. Basically, to me, it's a clash of journalism, narcissism. Do you know what I mean? It's just, yes, like a clash of the writers wanting to like have their say.
I think, and so from my background as an editor who commissions or sees the commissioning of debut novels, we do have an etiquette guide, like but we have a sense of what is okay and what is not okay. We will not annihilate debut novels. It's like a thing.
Even if they're from a previously published author, though, I know it was a memoir, but she was a very well-known person. So it's not the same as annihilating the book of a complete unknown.
So I don't think we reviewed it at the Telegraph. I'll have to check. But I think there is definitely a kindness of debut novels are always,
you're finding your feet.
They're usually not great. Most people regret their debut. Zadie Smith was saying the other day she couldn't reread her debut novel because it was so, even though it's meant to be one of her best, White Teeth, she just simply couldn't read it because it was like making her teeth like grind together. I think, and also books pages, there aren't that many of them. There's hardly any space. Why would you spend your time annihilating a debut novelist when you could be promoting? There are so many books.
There are other like better books that you could promote.
Yeah. You know, of course, if it's like Sebastian Faulks's 10th novel, absolutely, he can, you can be, it's not punching
down. Critical. Yeah. I see what you're saying in terms of like journalism etiquette. You don't need to tear down a debut novelist about their book. You can just be quiet.
And I think we as books editors and journalists, you really want to protect a fragile industry. And if we're knocking down debut novelists when it's already hard enough to get your book published.
I see what you mean. It's counterintuitive. You're actually publishing just,
You're crumbling an industry that's already weak. So that's my main issue with it. My second issue with it is that I actually don't think it's a well-written review, and I think it was not that clever, and I think it thinks it's more clever than it is.
I mean, that's kind of the irony. The review's trying to be very clever in a way that the novel was also trying to be very clever.
Yes.
And fell slightly short on both fronts.
I think it actually, if I'm going at it from a very like editor hat on, he didn't have enough examples. It was a lot of turns of phrase. And what are your actual concrete examples? He says her prose is thick like mayonnaise, doesn't actually give a quote.
However, just to be devil's advocate here.
Yes.
Again, I enjoyed the book. But some of his criticisms, I feel, do echo what you said to me at the time, i.e. very perhaps basic similes around eye colour, hair colour.
That's what it was.
All those kind of things.
That's why I couldn't get past the first few chapters because I was getting like the ick from some of the
I remember you had a big issue with the love interest's eyes being described as moss green.
Did I? Oh, yeah. Hilarious. Well,
hair was like the sunset, golden as the beach sand. I don't know. It was one of those like classic.
Oh God. I mean, similes, I'm sure I've written worse, but yes. And this is the issue with reading stuff as when you work in the industry, like you can't just read it like a normal person. We're constantly analysing it from the perspective of a journalist or
a
editor.
Literary perspective.
Yes. I'm sure the average person reading it is not having that kind of
I think it just depends
friction.
What kind of books you like as well. Like I really enjoyed Ghosts and I definitely take issue with the idea that an easy read is somehow lesser than a very challenging book because I just don't think that's true.
It's such a sexist
What I will
issue.
Say generally, and we'll get onto good material at the moment, is that everything I know about love really not only spoke to me, but I've remembered specific instances from it years and years later. Whereas both Ghosts and Good Material, while I enjoyed the process of reading them, they haven't moved me or changed me or done anything particularly powerful. You know, they're not books that I'll reference. They're not books that I would really, really recommend someone who was in a particular place to read. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say like, hey, this is a handbook for life. Like you've got to read this at any point.
Exactly. And I think, but that's
also
fine.
But everything I know about love, I would. Like, I literally don't have my copy. I went to dig out my copy for this chat. And I lent it to a friend years ago when she was going through a breakdown because I was like, you need to read this. It'll really take your mind off it. And, you know, it was like, it was in my arsenal of like special important books that you give to people when they really need them.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think one thing that was really interesting to come out of this hatchet job was this question of people who have kind of transcended criticism. So there was a comment piece in The Independent by Rupert Hawksley, who's a very good journalist. And he said, I wonder if something else was at play with regards to the reaction to Pierce's review. Why was there no outcry when, say, Katie Law in the Evening Standard described Martin Amis's latest novel, Inside Story, as erratic, rollercoasting, and frankly self-regarding? Or when in The Times, Joanna Thomas Core dismissed The Seduction by Joanna Briscoe as shrill and unstable from the beginning, with some of the worst dialogue I've ever read. etc., etc. It's difficult not to conclude that there are now two groups of authors, those who are happy to criticize and those who are not. What grants people access into that first group is unclear. And I think that's really
interesting.
Yeah, because you're right. I think Dolly Alderton, and I would say there are some other, Stormzy. Stormzy's music, I think, has become
Depends who you are, though, because people that were fans of his music originally are now like, really dismissive of
on Twitter, yes. Yeah. But I think critics are fucking scared.
Oh, critics wouldn't want to say anything. Yeah. I think with Dolly, I mean, even now, though, to even say that, yes, I enjoyed the book, but no, it's not one of my like top 10 novels ever, feels transgressive. I almost feel guilty to our audience who I know are also Dolly lovers. Guys, let me know what you think. Like, I don't want to be a hater, but they weren't the best books I've ever read. And I don't mean that in a really horrible way. It feels mean to say that somehow, I think it's because, when it's Dolly.
Yes.
Yeah, I had no trouble with being like, oh, I found really good, actually, self-indulgent.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Why did I feel like I could criticise that book, but I feel much more uncomfortable to criticise Dolly's writing? Perhaps because I love her other work so much. So it's almost like you don't want to devalue the things that you really have enjoyed from someone by criticising some of their output. Like, I don't think that the fact that Ghosts isn't the most eloquently written book of all time, that doesn't lessen her value to me at all.
No.
As a creative.
I also wonder if it's because Dolly does feel like a friend to so many of us women because she has spoken to us like friends.
We've got
her writing.
Back. Whereas who the hell's got fucking Martin Amis's back? Like, exactly. No one.
We feel treacherous being rude about her because I genuinely feel like I know her.
It's like if I bitched about your book. It's like if you wrote a book and I was like, it's not that good. Like, it feels literally like deeply transgressive.
And also, I think there is an issue, particularly in publishing and in journalism, where there is a circle of successful white middle-class women who constantly blurb each other's books, write extremely glowing reviews of each other's work, and it becomes this, like, self... what's it called?
It's the literary London lovey circle.
That's it. Yeah.
I think the Tattle Life has called them.
That's what it is. And it fuels this constant... kind of train track
insular.
Of praise. Yes.
And there's a few names that always pop up. And don't get me wrong, they are women that I really admire. Professionally, someone like Elizabeth Day is like the pinnacle, both as a
love
writer,
her.
As a podcaster, whatever. But you absolutely can't deny that there is this quite incestuous, almost quite elitist subset of the kind of British publishing world that definitely has its... has a cliqueyness to it.
Totally. And I actually think people are starting to find it icky. I have seen quite a few comments where it's like, people like Elizabeth Day and Dolly and all that lot have now been on each other's, and even Stephen Bartlett now to some extent, and I guess actually he's maybe an exception to the rule in terms of
the white middle class.
Yeah. But people who are constantly on each other's podcasts, they all say the same thing on each other's podcasts. I think because there's a bit of a swap going on. You come on my podcast, I'll come on your podcast.
Oh yeah, it's always like a you scratch my back.
Exactly. But it does mean there is a saturation of those voices.
I feel like it's the same with the book jacket write-ups.
The blurbing.
Though. The blurbing. Yeah. One woman in that circle, and I don't want to name her just in case I get it wrong, allegedly has said in interviews that she will write positive blurbs for friends knowing that they're not good books because they're friends. And I think while that's fine to a degree, it's also galling for the rest of us.
It's not only galling, but it's entrenching further the elitism and privilege of the publishing industry that is already so impenetrable. I don't even know how we fix it, but like, it's just furthering that.
Yeah, because the only people that are going to get published are the ones that operate within this very small ecosystem.
Exactly.
And yeah, actually, sometimes some of the books can feel a little bit disappointing, considering.
So I now, when I see that circle of writers blurb each other's books, it actually puts me off because I'm like, I don't even believe you. And I mean, there's just a massive issue, as we just keep saying, with publishing and journalism in general. Like, that's how we feel, despite being so lucky to work at, as Katha says.
And we're white, we're middle class, we're incredibly privileged, we're able-bodied. Like, we tick all those boxes.
We had an unpaid internship.
We were able to do those things that even give you an option to, like, get through the door.
Absolutely. Most people do not get that.
So I can totally see why it feels like quite like a kind of highfalutin exclusionary world.
Absolutely. So guys, we basically, I hope that hasn't been offensive to anyone. We had a bit of a chat before we recorded and we were like, we absolutely want to make clear that we are obsessed with all these writers. We love them. But I think it's important to bring nuance to a discussion that is very not nuanced.
I agree.
I think there is not enough nuance when it comes to women in the publishing industry, talking about other women, we need to be critical. And actually, and as I've said so many times, criticism is respect, actually. Like, if it's done constructively, unlike Barry Pierce's review, if it's done constructively, it means you're engaging respectfully with someone's work.
Exactly.
And it is my main issue with fan journalism. It's my biggest bugbear with it, with this essentially fan journalism. If you are just giving everything 4 or 5 stars and not engaging critically with someone's work, you're essentially not, you're doing it a disservice.
Hans, we have the best news for those of you based in London. Okay, how would you like to go to the best fitness classes in the capital for free? Yep, you heard me right, without spending a penny.
It's all so exciting, and it's thanks to our amazing partner Yonder, which, as regular listeners will know, is this incredible lifestyle credit card that allows you to earn points for every pound you spend that you can then redeem at a selection of lifestyle experiences across the city, so from restaurants and bars to shops, hotels, gyms and more.
So what's really fun is that the reward partners change each month, so loads to choose from. And this month, they've partnered with boxing club Cobox, which describes itself as where Fight Club meets nightclub. And then there's Boom Cycle, which is apparently a party on a bike. Cathers, that sounds like a bit of us.
And actually, it's a fab thing to do for when you want to swap the pub for something just a little bit more wholesome, but still hang out. So I am defo up for that.
Also, guys, the point system is so good that the other night I went to 45 German Street, one of my favourite restaurants, and I used my points with my boyfriend to get the entire £175 meal for free. Also, guys, good to know, the £15 monthly Yonder card fee includes comprehensive travel insurance. So compared to other credit cards on the market, it feels well worth the money.
Thank you so much to our amazing partner, Yonder. Get your first month free and 10,000 points when you join, then it's £15 a month thereafter. Please do make sure you borrow responsibly. T's and C's apply. Rep 66.7% APR variable. It really makes me think of the Anne Powers thing with Lana Del Rey.
Yes.
So Anne Powers, for those that don't remember, is a very well-respected music critic. She'd written for the LA Times, was writing music reviews for NPR, and she reviewed Lana Del Rey's album, Norman Fucking Rockwell. Lana Del Rey took issue with her review and teared her to absolute shreds on Twitter, basically. And then Anne Powers had to not only back herself and make clear that there were elements of the work that she really loved, it wasn't a kind of takedown, but also that this deep engagement with Lana Del Rey's art was actually incredibly flattering by nature of just being interested in a critical sense with someone's work.
Absolutely, she cared. And actually, I think people that will put themselves on the line to have honest, real, fresh ideas about someone's work is risky and brave.
But it's a lot more interesting than just hearing the same old thing rehashed time and time again, isn't it? Which is, in a way, while I agree it's a bit petty and it's a low blow and it's certainly a hatchet job, the review of Ghosts that we're talking about, I enjoyed reading it because it was different.
Absolutely, yeah. I think we both agreed that it was punching down and it wasn't constructive.
And it was unfair.
But
all the rest of it.
But it was fresh. And lastly, on that point, I think Sam Leith put it really well when he wrote a comment piece about this. He said, "You're more convincing if you're subtle. You're more effective if you're quoting wince-making examples of the author's prose rather than smothering the book in wince-making examples of your own." And I think that's exactly what Barry Pierce did wrong.
Bang on.
He made it all about his own little, oh, look how funny and Barbie I can be.
Which, in a way, he was then doing exactly what he was criticising the book for.
Exactly.
Okay, guys, so good material. It came out a week ago. If you haven't had a chance to read it yet, put a pause here. Come back to the episode.
Bookmark.
We are going to drop some spoilers. I just don't know how we can talk about the book without discussing the ending and things like that. So
we did give you several weeks to read it.
We gave them 1 week.
Oh,
it came out on the 9th.
Oh, yeah. Hard taskmasters.
Sorry, guys.
That we are.
Sorry. Oops. But we hope that you've enjoyed it. We'd love to know what you think. Do let us know. Honey, can you let me know what the hell you thought? Let's get into it.
So, unlike with Ghosts, I really liked Good Material. I thought it was really nice. So, recap, because it was about an hour ago that we said this. 35-year-old failing comedian Andy, very self-absorbed, very selfish, is dumped by his girlfriend of 3 years.
3 years, 10 months and 29 days.
His girlfriend, Jen. Yes. And the book is told from his perspective until right at the end, there is a coda from Jen where we finally hear her side of things. But most of the book is told from the quite insufferable protagonist of Andy, the failing comedian.
That was my beef. So I gobbled it up in literally like a weekend. I loved it as well. I found it really fun, really easy. However, I found Andy very annoying. I know he's meant to be super annoying. Again, like the protagonist in Very Good Actually, the divorced novel that I keep touching on because it's very similar to this book. But I did feel like surely he must be a bit more self-aware than he's letting on, kind of thing. Like, he...
I don't know any men like him, I must
say. Have an inkling as to why Jen ended it. So those of you that have read it will know that the whole book is a year in Andy's life, post-breakup, essentially trying to piece together the pieces of why she even broke up with him in the first place. That kind of wound me up. But I don't know if that's me coming to it from my own personal experience, in that while I have been broken up with before, it was like a very young, like, teenage boyfriend. And I've never really been in that scenario of, I guess, I've just had a very limited experience when it comes to heartbreak.
Yes. I've only been dumped once.
So sorry, guys. That's extremely not relatable of us. But I have been broken up with, and I got cheated on, and I was really upset. It definitely does, like, knock your ego. But that wasn't even really a serious boyfriend. That was, like, literally a 15-year-old teenage thing.
Can I say, my boyfriend cheated on me with my best friend.
That's really big.
She came to school the next day with a cupcake to apologise.
That is heartbreak right there.
To make it even worse, she said to me...
Are you still friends with her anymore?
No.
Is she listening?
No. She said,
I'll come for her.
No.
New best friend versus old best friend.
She went off the rails. She said to me, he said that you weren't a good pull.
Ew, pull.
I know, gross. And I was haunted by that comment, because it was my first kiss.
That's really mean of her, of him. God, why are teenagers just actually horrific? And
it took me about 2 years to get over that.
Well, I don't blame you, poor pet.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Pre my relationship now, I had one really serious long-term boyfriend, and we broke up because we were at uni. He was in Leeds, I was in Sussex, and we'd gone to uni, like, together. And after, like, a year or two of being at uni, obviously it just didn't work. So it wasn't like a tragedy. Like, we both came to the breakup knowing that it was completely the right thing for both of us. So I've never been in the scenario of having to unpick why someone's left me. So I don't know if I just had less time for it narratively, because to me, it's not, as Lena Dunham says in her blurb line on the front, achingly relatable.
Yes. Oh my God, touch word. Imagine if you both get dumped.
Oh, don't say that.
Stop. Yes. Well, sorry. I am lost for words, Cathers. No, I think I love all these memoirs purely with a kind of purient fascination, because I've never gone through heartbreak. I think that's why I loved Annie Lord's book, because I found it, I was like fascinated. I was like, oh my gosh, all these feelings I don't really have experience of.
Yeah. And I will say, even when I had the one, like, big breakup that I've ever had in my entire life, even though it was, like, mutual and it was totally the right thing, and both of us knew that it was 100% best for both of us, it did literally feel like, it felt like a bereavement. Like, it was a grief. Like, losing someone that I had spoken to every day for, like, 6 years, to then suddenly not be able to speak to them, it did very much feel that they died.
That is what I get whenever I've comforted girlfriends or guy friends. It's that.
So I think in some way, heartbreak plays on the same, like, emotions, doesn't
Definitely.
It?
Definitely. You have lost someone.
But Andy does get a little bit insufferable.
So, interesting to note, Dolly Alderton interviewed 15 men for the role of Andy.
Insight. Andy.
And a lot of it is pulled from the fact that, fun fact, she dated a lot of comedians, and for three summers went to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival because she wanted to be a comic. She wanted to be a stand-up comedian.
I did not know that, but that makes a lot of sense.
She did two gigs and then realised she was shit. Apparently,
you've got to be so brave to be a stand-up.
Oh, wow. My gosh. I mean, actually, I can imagine Dolly doing that, but she said, in her own words, she said she was
and
terrible.
And she's very funny.
Yes.
Naturally.
And she also says she read Frank Skinner's diaries and consulted Ivo Graham.
Well, the book is apparently based on her love of Nick Hornby's High Fidelity.
Right.
Which was, like, the first kind of male breakup, heartbreak novel to be very popular. I did love the insight into the comedy circuit. So it's interesting.
That was my favourite bit.
It was fun, wasn't it?
I love
different
worlds.
I think I've
mentioned
this in episodes before, but I have to say, for anyone that finds that kind of thing interesting, and how comedians all car share together and that type of stuff, Dave's, as in the TV channel Dave's, The World's Most Dangerous Roads, which pairs together comedians who are friends from the circuit to go and take on the world's most dangerous roads, is very funny. I reckon.
Yes. And I really loved even just little fun facts, like the etiquette of, if someone bombs on stage, you all have to leave the dressing room.
Yeah, so that, and you don't say goodbye, so it's not all good. However, and again, this isn't necessarily a criticism, I knew from the name of the title being Good Material and the fact that he's a comic, you know where it's going.
Yes.
He is going to turn the heartbreak into material.
Also, I should say that after the Russell Brand stuff,
there was a lot of comment pieces about why comedians can be so toxic. Rebecca Reid wrote quite a good piece about this for The Telegraph. About how she will not date comedians because all of her worst dating stories have been with comedians because they're so self-obsessed, make fun of women, make fun of the Me Too movement.
I mean, I think, have I said this to you before? Have I said it on air? I don't like stand-up. I don't find it that funny. I think most of stand-up punches down.
Yes.
I think it's always taking the piss out of women, minorities, disabled people, whatever. Like, I just don't find it particularly funny because I think it's always at the expense of others.
Mm.
Some people do it really well. Like, there are certain, like, Ricky Gervais stand-ups that I really enjoy, but generally it's not actually an art form that really speaks to me.
I agree. I do like some stand-up, but mostly when they are mining their own personal experiences in a universal way.
Like, picking people out the audience to make fun of what they look like. I just think it's lazy.
So I think bits where I thought maybe it was less relatable was when I thought that maybe Andy was being a bit of a mouthpiece for Dolly.
I very much felt, while I understand that she chose a male protagonist, to step away from having herself inserted in the book in the way that people argued Nina Dean, the protagonist of Ghosts, was, and obviously having mined her personal life, as we've gone into in extensive detail. Get why she used that distancing technique, but I just felt that I was reading Dolly as a man.
Yes. I mean, he's a great character and very credible.
Very well drawn.
Yes, very credible in lots of ways. And lots of people actually on Goodreads said that they couldn't deal with how unlikable he was, but I like unlikable characters.
I found him neurotic, and I knew that was kind of the point. Like, he has a folder in his phone where he takes a picture of the bald spot on the back of his head, like, every day.
That's quite believable.
And that's very believable. That's so what, like, a very insecure person would do, you know?
But there were some bits. Yeah, the bits that I found less credible were the first two pages where he writes a list of all the things why it's good that he's no longer with Jen.
Oh yeah, that really got to you, didn't it?
There were two lines that I just thought, this is very much, I'm reading a writer here. I'm reading Dolly being funny to herself. This is a little in joke with Dolly and Dolly. He writes in the list, Jen would never reject an OBE if it were offered to her. As if you would write that in a list about your a reason not to be with your ex-partner.
It's like she says she would reject it, but she wouldn't actually.
Yeah. And then once saw her nod respectfully at tiny jade spoon in the British Museum. Just can't imagine Andy as a man writing that on his list.
And I will say, a video that went live on the Sunday Times' YouTube recently with Dolly answering Agony Aunt questions as promo for this book does confirm that. Dolly was asked by her own therapist to write a list.
Right.
So for those that don't know, background, any fellow Hilo Huns that were always trying to figure out whether Dolly was or wasn't in a relationship, she in fact was a relationship in 2020 that ended badly, and that heartbreak was the inspo for this novel. So she went through her own breakup.
Yes. Do you know what? I think I'm so pleased that she pushed the boat out with her writing to write from a male perspective, because it's fucking hard.
It'd be so hard.
I couldn't bloody do it.
And you can see the researchers that's gone into it. And I really like her very realistic kind of drawing of male friendships.
Absolutely.
And how little men are able to lean on each other emotionally.
Those scenes are really good.
Yeah.
Also, my favourite scenes. Also, Andy and his mum. I thought that was very believable.
Yeah.
And also, my favourite bits were really odd scenes, which I'm glad she included, but they are quite weird. His friendship with his strange landlord, Morris.
Oh, I loved that when he's a lodger and he's got to move in with him. That felt very real, didn't
it? Felt very real. So Morris becomes obsessed with Julian Assange and writes in weekly letters.
All felt like really well drawn.
It was so good. Those are my favourite bits.
Whereas I didn't love Andy buying all of Jen's perfumes and throwing them into the canal. That felt very, again, I keep going back to it, but really good actually, Monica Heisey. Like, it felt quite like neurotic woman in her 20s does something mad that no normal person would actually do. And it's only these writers that self-mythologize themselves.
That's so true. Do you know what? That's the kind of thing that a woman would write about having done, even though she hadn't done it.
Absolutely, it sounds good for a novel.
Yeah. So true. That is exactly.
Like, who would actually waste that kind of money on perfumes and then throw them in a canal?
When I was reading that,
I just wouldn't.
What the fuck?
Ooh, okay. I've got to say, though, did you feel the same as me? Because while I really, really appreciate Dolly writing from a male perspective, I can't lie, I think I must still find her female perspective more compelling, because I was just desperate to get to the end, to get to the ex Jen side of the story. So the final chapter, like the last less than quarter of the book, is from her perspective. And that was the bit that I really wanted. And I think the book needed that, and it made the ending satisfying to understand why she didn't want to be in the relationship anymore.
So true. And I think, and she's not, and I think this speaks to the warmth of Dolly's writing again, that we don't hate Jen.
No, not at all.
At any point.
So actually, for those that might want a refresher, again, massive spoiler, so this is absolutely not one for you if you haven't read it yet. But I think a lot of her issues are around his immaturity, and she absolutely is a little bit annoyed, and very fairly, and I think this speaks to quite a lot of women's experiences, about the kind of burden of having to carry his entire emotional life because he won't discuss his feelings with his friends ever. That was frustrating for her. But ultimately, the main reason that she ends it is because she realizes is that she just doesn't want to be in a relationship. She wants to be on her own.
Yes, which I think is an amazing thing to admit.
Yes, and why does it feel so radical in 2023?
And actually, this is exactly what Dolly Alden herself has been standing for years.
Literally, she doesn't even know if she wants to be in a relationship. And actually, I think, great. Like, why is it that we associate a relationship with a kind of end goal of life? Lots absolutely of people are happier on their own. They prefer their own company. They like holidaying by themselves. They like having a bathroom to themselves. You know, there are so many benefits. But it's society exactly that makes you feel like you have to be coupled up.
Exactly. And that women without a partner are tragic for some reason. It's great. And actually, I do think there's been a shift societally as well, at least in my friends. I am noticing that it's actually unacceptable now for me when I'm with my single friends to be like, how's your love life? Like,
yeah,
who are you dating?
And only ask them about what's going on in their romantic world. What about their jobs? What about their families? What about everything absolutely else they have going on?
Or like,
but is this something that we all do, isn't it? It's like, it's so deeply entrenched that romantic love is the superior love,
exactly,
which, as you say, Dolly has been railing against for years, and always said that you should treat your friendships and your platonic relationships with just as much kind of care and respect.
Absolutely. But yes, that the idea that you're not whole without a partner is such still a really difficult, pernicious idea that we all have. But I've noticed with a lot of my single friends now, a lot of them just have just checked out of dating. They just stopped dating because they don't care enough to settle.
Yeah, and spend your weekends schlepping around London or wherever you live, having to go on these dead end dates. Like, that is not a good use of your free time. We're all so busy as it is. Modern life demands so much of us. Do you really want to spend what little free time you have going through this rigmarole that you feel like you have to do societally, but you're not even interested in? Because I will say, while dating does sound really fun, as we touched on in our Why Modern Dating Is So Broken,
hid along to a singles night.
Yeah, it's also tough. And there's a lot of admin.
A lot of admin. But I love how it's now actually become a bit socially unacceptable to assume that someone's dating. Actually, they're perfectly fine not dating. And it's weird if I mention that as if that's weird.
I guess what's trickier for women, and yet again, we've pulled the short straw biologically in that sense.
Yeah.
It matters in a way that it doesn't for men. And this is partly why it's societally so ingrained, because a man can be a kind of bachelor playboy in his 40s and then he might feel like settling down in his 50s. Whereas as a woman, if you want to have children and you want to have a family, you don't have the luxury and privilege of waiting until you're in your late 40s.
Very true. And I should actually caveat that my friends who don't care about dating so much anymore are ones who are also quite at peace with not necessarily having children.
Whereas I think when people go on and on about the ticking biological clock. Of course, when you're in your early 30s or as soon as you've passed 29, you're going to start getting anxious. Our entire culture has like pummeled us with that message our whole lives.
Absolutely. And in fact, some of the most moving scenes in Good Material are when Jen discusses her stress about the fact that she is like the last one not to be pregnant. And she discusses a betrayal she feels when her best friend, who she'd kind of always, I guess, agreed that they would be childless together, she falls pregnant. And Jen calls it a betrayal. She actually uses that word. And then she says, "When I woke the next day, I realized the feeling I was experiencing was not anger or jealousy or bitterness. It was grief. I had no one left. Huge parts of them had disappeared and there was nothing I could do to change that. Unless I joined them in their spaces, on their schedules, with their families, I would barely see them." I think that is so very relatable.
It is.
I think that is. And we've discussed it together when I'm like, "Cathers, when you get pregnant, will we even understand each other?
Can you not have a child too soon?" Like, there is a gulf between parents and non-parents just because of the nature of your lifestyles being so different.
Exactly.
Like, no one's right and no one's wrong. It's people making different choices. But I can really see why long-term friendships are put under so much pressure at that point in life.
I even noticed it when we were a bit younger, if there were like two single people in a friendship group. You know how you often notice in friendship groups, it's quite cyclical. Everyone has a boyfriend and then suddenly, you know, and then everyone's dumped again and it comes in circles. And there were points I saw where there were like a last few remaining people who were single or last two. And when one of them got a boyfriend, there would be a sense of betrayal.
I know what you mean. There's a slight... I've seen this happen among female friends where when they've been each other's like single wing women, when then they both get into relationships, there's almost some resentment there.
There is. And I've actually noticed it being in a long-term relationship because it's now been years since like me and Issa like dedicated all our time together because we know, you know, once you get to a certain stage in a relationship, you no longer need to constantly dedicate everything to each other. But when I then have friends who get new boyfriends, I almost feel a loss because I'm like, for me, boyfriends aren't everything anymore because we've been together for so long.
I see what you mean.
Do you see what I mean? Yeah, that's quite difficult to explain.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm actually now back at a stage where I really prioritize
friendships.
You're
like available most of the time.
I'm really available,
yeah. I see what you mean. You're not like, sorry, I'm actually with so-and-so's. You know, when you, like you say, you're in a new throes of a relationship and you're always holidaying with them or going to meet their family or doing things with their friends or whatever.
It's
so you're quite busy.
Yeah. Whereas, I think you absolutely should give people room to do that. It's so important that people
need to lose themselves
in a relationship.
Oh, of course, they need to do that. And we got to do that 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
So.
And also, I think I'm actually very lucky that Issa and I are in the same friendship group. So
yeah, you do a lot of shared social stuff, don't
exactly.
you? Whereas actually, I have to say, I do agree with what you're saying, but I still think it's really important, like 10 years in, to carve out time for one another. Like Molly and I put aside lots of time for just him and I, outside of like our friends and stuff like that. Because I think if we didn't, you could end up essentially being roommates.
Yes,
if
I think
you
that's
don't
a really good
that
point.
Romantic space.
Yes. Yeah, I think there was a point, I can't remember when it was, where we were like, we're always with our friends, always.
And actually, even though it feels counterintuitive to be like, sorry guys, we can't come out with all of you tonight because we're on a date, it's important for your relationship to occasionally do that.
I totally agree.
That was part of the issue with Andy and Jen, wasn't it? That
yes.
she just felt that he was an immature partner and they didn't do much together other than sit in front of the TV. That's kind of one of her like beefs that she says at the end.
Yeah.
Is that they're... romantic life wasn't exciting or interesting. It was all very domestic, and that's actually not what she wanted. She didn't just want someone to slob on the sofa with, whereas that's exactly what Andy wants. He's like, I wanted someone to grow old with and watch shit TV with and talk about what we're cooking for dinner that night. You know, all those little...
Exactly, and she actually says there was a point that she realised the point where Andy stopped calling her sexy and stopped calling her sweet, stopped slapping her on the arse.
Oh my goodness, I forgot. Oh, I'm glad you remembered that little tidbit.
Because I think everyone goes through that relationship, right? Where you get so easy, you stop being so exciting. Like you being naked no longer is the frisson of new adventures.
No, it could be like you're literally just running from bathroom to bath to bedroom to get a towel. I guess it's a shift. Like you go from being new to one another to like so familiar.
Exactly.
And some people find real comfort in that. Some people love that part of a relationship. That's what Andy, I think, is really getting at in the book. He loved the familiarity. Jen found it stifling and boring.
You've got to have both.
And I also think it depends on the individual. And that's partly why they clearly weren't well suited as a couple, because
yes,
they both wanted
true.
Different things out of life. He wanted this like very simple, easy, secure domestic sphere. And she wanted a bit of like fun and excitement in her life and a bit of like non-routine and not knowing what the future will hold. Like that, the idea of knowing what the future holds, I think depresses her. Whereas for him, it doesn't.
She is braver. And actually, I really loved the phone conversation that Jen has at the end with Andy's mum. And she says to Andy's mum, you know, do you ever think about like whether if you hadn't had children, what your life would look like? And Andy's mum says, I love my son, but do I ever think about what my life would have been like had I been brave enough not to become a mother?
Ooh.
Had I been brave enough to even imagine what that life could have been like? Yes, I think about that all the time.
Wow. I mean, this is where Dolly just gets hole in ones always, doesn't she?
This
like
is where
kind
she's
of millennial female experience from kind of girlhood to womanhood, all of these like existential issues that face modern women today. She just really works through in such a sensitive, bang on way.
Yeah, I thought that was so good.
Love it.
I mean, actually, I have to say, look, would I have enjoyed the book more had it all been from Jen's perspective? Yes.
Yes, I would. But, I'm not going to lie. But I respect Dolly's literary bravery, trying something new, having a new perspective. As we touched on, she wanted someone who wasn't so closely tied to who she is because there's so much intrigue around her personal life. As we were saying, listening to the high-low, God, I was desperate to know what was going on with her boyfriends and her romantic
life. Totally, I still Google it sometimes.
I can't help
like,
but want to know,
Dolly
which I know. Yeah, it's like, I don't know, a bit basic perhaps, and I feel slightly ashamed of myself doing it, but I still really want to know.
Absolutely.
I'm desperate for her to like hard launch a partner, which is feeding into this entirely regressive view that women must have partners. And I'm catching myself doing it, and I don't know why that kind of base side of me so wants that, but it does.
But actually, I would say that our fascination with Dolly is actually because she doesn't prioritize partners in this way, we obsess over her friends because yes. She puts female friendship at the forefront of her whole life.
However, and I'm literally a broken record, but the Annie Lord Times piece ends on a yes. romantic cliffhanger. So even Annie Lord knew that it's not just
because Dolly's
us.
About to go on a date.
She's about to have someone round for dinner. And she stops short at saying who the someone is.
And good on her, because, yeah, she absolutely shouldn't offer her entire life up for consumption like no. for us virus-stick, nosy little girls.
More.
So, guys, a lot to think about. Now, let us know what you think.
Yes. Any other great breakup books we might have missed? I mean, we didn't even touch on Fleischman Is in Trouble.
Loved that book.
I didn't read it. I did watch the Disney adaptation. So of Taffy Bredessa Aichner's novel, Fleischman Is in Trouble, which is told from the perspective of Toby, a divorcee. It was made into a Disney miniseries with Claire Danes, Jesse Eisenberg and Adam Brody, which I loved.
I didn't watch the show, but I loved the book. I should watch
the show.
Oh,
you've got to watch it.
Very, very sympathetic and very believable middle-aged man dating for the first time.
Told by a female author.
Yeah, she. I thought she nailed that.
However, I will say that Fleischman, maybe it's just the series, because obviously it can't be first-person narrative in a miniseries, but you get quite a lot of the female perspective as well, in a sense. Like yes. Claire Danes' character's like story arc is very much central.
Yes, I think there's also a female friend character. Who is also... Is she the narrator? I think there's like a
yeah,
narrator.
Yeah, the friend is the narrator. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Actually, yes. So it's not a first-person book. I assumed that Fleischman was told from Toby's perspective, but it's not. It's just about him as the central character.
Yes, it's third person. Yeah. But it is very, you know, it's very much from his perspective, but told through the narrator, yeah.
I mean, Toby is this kind of neurotic character as well, like Andy, isn't he? I'm never going to know how much Andy is meant to be likable or not. I'm not quite sure. What I will say, however, though, is while I am absolutely here for the bad boy lit, I am not so sure about the wet boy lit.
Ah, wet boy lit.
I feel like that's Andy, right?
I am
just
obsessed.
Wet boy lit. And I really respect Dolly doing it. I think it's a refreshing, interesting perspective. I loved reading from it. It's not a perspective that I'm particularly interested in.
It's the equivalent to sad girl lit.
Yes. Is that actually a thing?
Yeah.
Funny. Yeah.
Wet Boy Lit. I love that. However, in comparison to Wet Boy Lit, I should recommend a very good memoir about a breakup called In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado. She's Cuban. It's a 2019 memoir which chronicles the physical and verbal abuse in a same-sex relationship. And I think this memoir was really important because there is so little literature on abuse within the LGBTQ community, because as Carmen Maria Machado says herself, this is her quote, we desperately need good PR. She said, yes. Queer folks need that good PR to fight for rights we don't have, to retain the ones we do.
Yeah.
But haven't we been trying to say this whole time that we're just like you? And it's so moving.
I remember that book coming out in the Dream House. It's ringing a huge bell to me.
Yeah, it was so amazingly written. And it's so important, I think, to like just essentially show a very nuanced and real and show a very 3D portrait of same-sex relationships.
And I think that's kind of what we've been saying about heartbreak all along, right? And what Dolly's appeal really hinges on is that heartbreak is a universal experience.
Absolutely.
And so no matter the relationship, the gender, the dynamics, the ages, there's always something incredibly familiar about those tales.
Exactly. Also, a very good novel about heartbreak from the male perspective. It's one of my favourite books, Stoner by John Williams, published in 1973, which the New Yorker described as the greatest novel you haven't read. My dad bought it for me about 10 years ago. It's about like a middle-aged university professor whose marriage crumbles after his wife gives birth and he has an affair. But it's just so moving and just so lovely.
Okay.
Really recommend it.
Well, I'll read that.
And you have one as well, which we both loved, but you in particular.
Do I?
Ariel Levy's The Rules Do Not Apply.
Oh, I mean, you know that's like one of my like top 10 books ever. I am salty about the fact that I lent you my copy and never got it back.
I think it's at my parents, but I think I might just have to buy you a new one.
Yeah. So Ariel Levy's, because I literally do want to read it again. And that's what I will say. And this is no shade to Good Material or to Ghosts. They are just not books that I would read again, having read them once. Ariel Levy's memoir, The Rules Do Not Apply, has literally stayed with me since I read it about 7 years ago. It's a very complicated breakup that she goes through. So it's a story all about grief, and I kind of almost don't want to paraphrase it and not do it justice enough, but essentially she has a very late term miscarriage. Having flown to Mongolia, she's in a same-sex relationship with a woman called Lucy at this point, and they've obviously gone through quite a laborious process in order to actually even start a family. So a lot of trauma obviously comes from losing the baby. It is such a powerful example of storytelling.
Shall we end on your very funny story in the gym?
Oh, yeah. So, guys, thank you for writing reviews. We really appreciate it. And we will continue to dangle bait in front of you so that we get those written reviews in. I'm going to share an embarrassing story since Els did last week. I was trying to think off the top of my head what my most kind of go-to one was, and the pure mortification that stood out to me was a few years ago. Hopefully he's not listening to this, probably not his kind of thing, but I was
I just don't think he would be
training with a PT at the Fitness First that we both used to go to in Oxford Circus. Yes. He did these kind of introductory offers. I was like, God, I need to get into the gym. I kind of like, you know, was wrangled by his sales and decided, yes, I will do these PT.
Gavis, I don't think you're being quite truthful there. What were you really beguiled by? Not necessarily his sales.
Oh, no. I mean, he was quite good looking. And that obviously made things a little bit more awkward. Like, I was like, why does my fucking personal trainer have to be hot? Like, why can't he just...
Personal trainer should not allow to be hot.
And it'd already happened to me once before when I had done a feature on the Anthony Joshua boxing gym, BXR. They had set me a personal trainer then, obviously, because it was part of a feature. And they set me up with this guy who was like, literally... part-time model, part personal trainer.
No,
I'm just
stop.
Like, why? You I just can't. Don't want to be training with this person. Anyway, I then have this objectively very good-looking trainer at the Fitness First, but he had approached me and he'd done them cheap, basically. So I was like, hell yeah, I'll train with you, because he'd only been qualified for 6 months. So he was like, I'll do them for like £30 a session. So yes, I was like, I will do this. I've always wanted to have a PT. I'm going to do it for like 6 weeks. Firstly, it's very embarrassing when he's doing all my measurements and I forget that he's doing measurements that day. As we say, when you're in a long-term relationship, you sometimes don't think about certain things to do with how you look. And
you
my legs were extremely hairy, and I was wearing period stain pants that day when I had to pull my trousers down and have him like do my thigh measurements. And I'm like, great, these pants.
Did you pull your trousers down in front of him?
Yeah, I had to. He was like, right, we're doing your measurements. And I had to like literally like be standing there with my trousers around my ankles while he like measured me with a bloody tape measure. It was mortifying.
With your period stain pants?
Yes. Obviously, as in they weren't like freshly period stained. It was like,
freshly period.
You know what I mean? As in like, you know, when they just like, you've worn them previously. All the girls here will know I'm talking
I'm sorry
about.
To our male listeners, but
sorry for the
you'll probably
TMI.
All have experience.
And yeah, sorry for that. And that's not even the embarrassing story.
No,
the embarrassing story is once we started training, I then one day have to do this exercise, which is like where you hang downwards to then do sit-ups. Do you know what I mean? Your knees are like catched into this thing. And can I just say the aforementioned...
I'm quivering with fear.
The aforementioned hot guy was also around the periphery. So he was like nearby to when I was doing this. So it was like double embarrassment. He was like training another trainer. So you know when there's like loads of trainers around and they all know each other and they'll have jokes and you're like, why is this happening? Anyway, I'm doing these sit-ups and out of nowhere, I don't know how and why, a fart came out as I sat up. So I sat up and it was like... And it didn't, like, obviously it wasn't, like, stinky or anything like that, but he literally said straight away, did you just fart? And I obviously...
I actually cannot cope. To be questioned upon the fart.
Like, straight away. It was, like, there's no way I could have slid out. Like,
what did you say?
I was so embarrassed, obviously. I was literally dying. Because also, obviously, I didn't, like, choose to let the fart out. Like, I did say no. What else are you going to say? I could have said yes. When it was not just him, but the other two guys, like, right behind him.
It was
all in their, like, early 20s. And are all fitness freaks. No, I just didn't feel comfortable being like, yes, I just farted. I couldn't say it.
Was it indisputably a fart?
So he just looked at me, like, shocked, like, with a smile. Like, did you just fart? And I was like... no. And he was like, yeah, you did. And like, really, in hindsight, I should have just been like, yes, I did. But because I'd already said no, you can't then be like, actually, yes.
So, and it didn't smell.
No, it was literally just a loud trumpet sound.
A little trumpet.
A little poof of air as my stomach bent in half. Because I was like hanging upside down doing a sit-up.
So you were also in a vulnerable position in the air.
Yes, upside down with him like standing next to me and my bum's like in the air facing upwards.
Also, were you on your period?
Because... No, I wasn't.
Oh, okay.
God.
Just wearing the period pants on your non-period.
These are two separate days. Or maybe they would say I don't even know.
By the way, my chair sounds like I'm constantly farting.
Yes.
Can I just say
stop
it's
that.
The chair.
Farting in kind of... Sorry.
In solidarity. No, whenever I laugh, it creates this horrible sound. Yeah. Kath is like, it's so funny.
I know. And I had to be like, no, it was me, my legs squeaking on the leather. I had to make an excuse about like the squeak of the leather, but like he knew and I knew.
It was a queef.
Well, no, thank God it wasn't. But I mean, that is our story for a whole other day.
What?
But I've never understood the demonization of queefs. Oh. and we'll get into that another time.
I have so many stories I can't even say on air.
But anyway, it was really embarrassing. Oh. And to this day, I am hoping he doesn't listen and knows that I didn't fat fart. So
I'm really bitter,
Ian, if you're listening,
that you got to bury the story at the end of a 1 hour, 40 minute podcast.
I know, your pants story at the start
was in the first 1 minute.
Actually, while they're all here, could you please tell your sisters?
Oh my God.
Because it's just too classic, the halls.
We are just so vile.
I mean, I just love that your younger sister is clearly so like you. An icon.
We are very much cut from the same cloth. So, yeah, she was congratulating me on my story on WhatsApp. And then she also said, it reminded me of when my period pants fell out of my bag in my very first teaching job in the office. And I came back from the toilet and the pants were face up on my chair.
That might just trump yours.
Well, the very disturbing thing about that is someone picked up her period pants.
What?
And put them on her chair.
Oh, so they'd fallen on the... I thought they'd fallen out onto the chair.
Well, it's actually unclear from her WhatsApp.
Right, we will give you part two next week.
Because how would your pants...
No, surely not. They picked them... Oh, my good God, that is just awful.
Well, anyway, so...
If anyone would like to share their anonymized story with us, do. You can send us a DM and we will remove your name and likeness from the retelling.
Yes. Can I also say shame on one of my best friends who messaged me straight after the episode saying, I'm so sorry that happened to you.
Oh,
way to make me feel...
Oh my God, I love that. As in, like, it more stressed. It's a funny story and actually it's a deep trauma.
Yeah. I was like, oh no, should I not?
You're like, oh, it's just a day in the life for me.
Yeah.
Well, on that note...
Can we just say I'm really sorry to our boyfriends for what we just spoke about?
Well, lucky for me, mine doesn't listen. Only yours. So.
I'm so sorry, yes.
Sorry about that.
Sorry, babe. Yes. Anyway, that is the end of the show.
That is the end of the show.
Sorry, this episode, not the entire show. We should say, by the way, that as much as we harped on about the incestuous circle of the media lovies, we acknowledge that we very much had loads of them on our podcast recently and we're part of the problem.
Yeah, well, like we said, it's a small old circle.
Exactly. But, you know.
On that note,
yeah,
I think we perhaps ought to draw this to a close.
We should bow out now whilst we can.
Enjoy, guys. Do rate, review, and subscribe. If you give us more reviews, we'll be back with more embarrassing stories.
Yes. God, no, we must not mine our personal lives. We're part of the first person industrial complex.
No, but I don't mind telling our gorgeous listeners I feel like it's like a safe community and I trust everyone there and you're not committing it to like the written page for an audience that don't know or like you.
Guys, if any of you in a couple of years end up writing horrid things about these stories on Tattle Life,
I will come for you.
I will come for you. You're not allowed. It's very mean.
And with that, goodbye.